talk about the thermodynamic Vedantas. instead, we'll be talking about something called projective Lewin permutation statistics, which I'll explain what that means. That's a title, some article to some recent ideas about analogs of non-Abelian gradient in higher dimensions. And this is work done in collaboration with a bunch of my colleagues at Station Q, Michael Friedman, Hastings, Xiaoliang Qi, Kevin Walker, and Chen Ranlong. Roy?
Yes, yeah,
thanks.
Okay.
For the broadcasting
world. Okay, so. Okay, so how do we think about exotic statistics in two dimensions? Well, if you want to compute the quantum mechanical amplitude for a system of particles which are at some initial positions, x1, x2, x3, at some initial time, t0, to end up at those same positions at later times, well, what Feynman told us is you just sum over all possible trajectories. And he further said you're supposed to weight all these different trajectories by e to the I times the classical action. And the reason you're supposed to weight it that way is in order to ensure consistency with the classical limit. I guess they should really be divided by h bar here, and in the h bar goes to zero limit, this gets concentrated on the classical trajectories, and so that's how the classical limit emerges there. Now, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, actually, there's a little bit of a quirk here, which is that the space of histories is disconnected. So this argument about the classical limit doesn't really hold here because you're not continuously deforming from trajectory like this to a trajectory like this. And so, in fact, you're free to give an independent phase, relative phase, to those two classes of trajectories. Okay. Another way of saying the exact same thing is that the n particle configuration space in two dimensions has a non-trivial fundamental group. So if you look, for instance, let's just look at the two-particle case. If you have two particles in two dimensions, two hardcore particles in two dimensions, then the configuration space is four-dimensional, actually. But if we just focus on its most important features, well, it's really just the relative position variable, x1 minus x2. The center of mass degree of freedom, of course, is trivial topologically. And the distance between the two particles is also trivial topologically. So you might as well fix the distance between the two particles. And then the configuration space is just the circle. And this has non-trivial fundamental group, which is just the integers. And that's the underlying reason why, or part of the reason why, you have anions in two dimensions. In three dimensions, on the other hand, the configuration space of two particles, okay, the relative coordinate, if you fix the distance between them, lies on the surface of a sphere. That has trivial fundamental group, and so that's why you only have bosons and fermions. So bosons and fermions correspond to the case in which the particles are identical, so that rather than the surface of the sphere, you have RP2 instead, and that has fundamental group, which is Z2. So in this discussion, I said we need to take the particles to have a hard core so that the origin is excluded, but that turns out to be superfluous for reasons that I can mention later. Okay. Now, so that's a two-particle case. If you go to the more than two-particle case, then the fundamental group of configurations of the multi-particle configuration space is the Bray group. Okay. That's generated by by counterclockwise exchanges. So if you have just label your particles 1 up to n, and if you do a counterclockwise exchange of particles I and I plus 1, that's one of the generators of the Bray group that we'll call sigma I. And the Bray group is generated by all of the sigma I's from I equals 1 up to n minus 1. And if you have two sigmas that are far apart, so if I minus j is greater or equal to 2, they commute. And if they are neighboring, I and I plus 1, they, of course, don't commute. But they satisfy this relation over here. And these relations together with the sigmas generates, those are the only two relations that are satisfied by the sigmas. And so you can then multiply them together in arbitrary ways to generate the Bray group. In three and higher dimensions, I said the permutation group is the fundamental group of the configuration space. And actually, it's defined by the exact same relations plus one extra, which is that a permutation squares to one. Okay. And this is where the great simplification comes about. This is an infinite group, and this is a group of size n factorial. Now, So as I said, in two dimensions, the Bray group allows for the possibility of anyons. So this divides into roughly two categories, or into two classes. There are one-dimensional representations of the Bray group, so that's a complicated non-abelian group. However, its representations can be abelian, and the one-dimensional representations are abelian anyons. That includes, of course, fermions, bosons, Boltzmann quasi-particles, the electric and magnetic charges in the toric cone, and so on. And then, of course, really sort of the generic case mathematically, although perhaps more of a special case physically, are the higher dimensional representations of the Bray group, which correspond to non-abelian anyons. Okay, that's what has possible applications to quantum computing, although I'm not going to talk about that today. Now, yes?
So when you have an n particle, whether high means exponential in n or still means a finite number.
Yeah, so that,
there's a little confusion.
Can you say it again? If you have a...
suppose we have n particle, whether high not equal to 1 means exponential in n or means something finite but bigger than 1.
Okay, yeah, so I'm going to address that in the very next comment, which is that, these higher dimensional representations are non-abelian anyons for a fixed number of particles, n. Now, in reality, in physical systems, you want to consider n, allow n to vary, okay? So you might want to allow particle creation, and you'd want to be able to create particles in a way that's consistent with, you want these braiding rules to be consistent with particle creation. So in particular, you don't want just one Bray group representation, you want a family of Bray group representations, because you want to be able to create particle-antiparticle pairs. And in fact, you want something more general than that. You don't just want to be able to create pairs out of vacuum, you also want to be able to annihilate them to the vacuum and fuse them to other particle types, okay? So you're very naturally led to consider not just individual representations of the Bray group, but families subject to consistency conditions, and you end up with a braided fusion category once you, you know, won't require that. And so that gets back to your talk. So that will lead you to exponential degeneracies in those cases, as you know, okay?
Dimensional representation for any n, or such things just don't exist.
Yeah, I don't know of any. Yeah. Okay, so an example, which Israel mentioned in his talk, perhaps the simplest example, I know Paul thinks Fibonacci anyons are the simplest example, so one of the simplest examples of non-abelian anyons are Ising anyons. This is a theory in which there are three particle types with one non-trivial fusion rule, and the name Ising anyon refers not only to the state of matter, but also to the particular anyon type, sigma, or often called sigma, which is non-abelian, okay? And the Hilbert space of Ising anyons, if you have two n Ising anyons, the Hilbert space can be understood in the following terms, which is that you have a Majorana, a fermion operator associated with each of these particles, so that's a self-conjugate operator, such that the operators square to one and all anti and different operators anti-commute, so they satisfy Clifford algebra. And the minimal dimension for a representation of this algebra is 2 to the n minus 1 dimensional. So as we were talking about, this is a higher dimensional representation and, in fact, exponential in the number of particles. And the representation of the Bray group generator, so if you look at the generator sigma I, its representation takes the following form. Now, in higher dimensions, you can also consider higher dimensional representations. They are not higher dimensional representations of the Bray group, but of the permutation group, okay? But these are actually not interesting. It's been known for some time that if you look at higher dimensional representations of the permutation group, those which are consistent with locality, meaning that if you take many of the particles far away and just look at a small subset, that it decomposes, those basically, in fact, all can be understood as having some local degree of freedom on each particle, okay? So you might erroneously think that you had some large dimensional representation of the permutation group if you had 2n particles and a 2 to the 2n dimensional Hilbert space, but actually that's really just a two-state system attached to each one, okay? So really, in some sense, there's nothing interesting. This is called parastatistics often, but it really isn't interesting from our point of view. To draw a distinction, a system of non-abelian anyons, it's not possible to do that. If you did somewhat artificially try to do that, you, of course, would get back to the concept of a quantum dimension, and that's not in general an integer, so there's not any simple way to think of it as, in fact, there isn't really any way to think of it as a local Hilbert space attached to each particle. Now, so that was all really by way of introduction to a recent paper that Teo and Kane wrote, in which they constructed a three-dimensional model in which there are hedgehog-like singularities in this model that have Majorana and fermion zero modes. So one way to think about this model is to just to write this down as a Dirac equation for Majorana spinners, which are coupled to something like a quote-unquote order parameter field. Okay, so here, I apologize for the notation. Here, these gammas have nothing to do with the gammas I had two or three slides ago. These are gamma matrices in the Dirac equation. And these capital gammas are a different set of three matrices. All of these anti-commute with each other, okay, and square to one. The quote-unquote order parameter field N combines the real and imaginary parts of the supernudging gap and basically the mass, which tunes you through a band inversion from an ordinary to a topological insulator. Okay. And the nice feature of this Dirac equation is that if you take a topologically non-trivial configuration of this N vector, okay, which lives, if you fix its magnitude, then N just lives on the surface of a sphere. And if you consider a topologically non-trivial configuration, in other words, a hedgehog or something with, let's say, a winding number one, then it has a zero mode, okay, a Majorana fermion zero mode on localized about that defect. Okay, so as a result, it's basically the same algebra. In fact, you could have asked this question before this paper. You could have said, well, that algebra that I wrote earlier, that Clifford algebra, there's nothing particularly special about that to two dimensions. What happens in higher dimensions if I had Majorana fermion zero modes? And that question is sort of sharpened because there's a specific example in which you have that. There's now a 2 to the n minus 1, again, dimensional Hilbert space for 2n hedgehogs. And, of course, now the natural question is what happens when these hedgehogs are permuted. Okay. Yes?
Singularity actually is.
Yes. It's so this map, okay, so in the n vector lives on the surface of the sphere, so let's fix its magnitude. So let's assume that you're in a situation in which its magnitude is fixed, and I'll explain later why you might want to do that. So it lives on the surface of the sphere, and if you, so there's some configuration, you have a map from every point in space to the sphere, and if you look far away from the origin, let's say, and that map is now a map from the surface of the sphere containing the origin to the sphere, and if that map has, let's say, winding number one, then it's a kind of topological defect I'm talking about. So in particular, is there chalk? Oh. I'm talking about something that's far away from the origin. You know, it looks like this. Okay, so it's pointing outward like that. Capital gammas are three. So these are the gamma matrices, what you would usually call the gamma matrices. These are three additional matrices which also anti-commute with these and anti-commute with each other in square to one. Okay. So we have this peculiar situation now that we've got these zero modes in higher dimensions, and so it looks like we have a system with 2n particles and a number of states that's not an integer to the n or integer to the 2n. And so it's kind of natural to ask what happens when you start permuting these things, okay? Because, you know, it looks like you're going to end up with a higher dimensional representation of the permutation group. On the other hand, which is not just a tensor product of local Hilbert spaces, and so that seems to be a contradiction, okay? And Teo and Kane further showed that if you exchange two of these hedgehogs, you get this unitary transformation, which is actually up to a phase, exactly the same unitary transformation we saw in two dimensions in the case of Ising anions. And also that, by extension, if you have a pair of these, if you can do two of these exchanges, which, as we know, leaves the positions of the hedgehogs unchanged, then that doesn't move the hedgehogs, but nevertheless performs the following non-trivial unitary transformations. Now, it doesn't move the hedgehogs, but it actually twists them, and I'll explain a little bit later what that means, okay? So I'm being a little bit telescopic in discussing Teo and Kane's idea because I'm going to explain it in more detail later. And so some aspects of it are special to their model that I don't want to discuss too fully now. Okay. And all these results may seem a little mystical right now, but actually, time permitting, some aspects of this I can give a rather different and much simpler pictorial explanation for. Okay. So this raises some obvious questions. Well, first of all, is their paper right? Okay. Is their conclusion right that you have these unitary transformations? And then second of all, if we take the point of view that I introduced in thinking about exotic statistics in the beginning of this talk, you know, the natural questions are, first of all, what is the configuration space of 2n of these hedgehogs? Okay. What is its fundamental group? Okay. And really, in a sense, asking what its fundamental group is basically like asking what the question was that Teo and Kane answered, because they provided us with a set of unitary transformations. And what you might want to ask is, well, what is this a representation of? Okay. So that's really what the second question there is. Why does it have a non-trivial, non-abelian representation? Are there others? Okay. So this seems to be a three-dimensional analog of Ising anions. Is there a three-dimensional analog of Fibonacci anions? It's a natural question. And you know, and can you really have non-trivial particle statistics in three dimensions? Okay. In order to answer this question, I have to take a slight detour through the topological classification of gapped free fermion Hamiltonians. Okay. So what is this? So if we don't forbid, okay, the gap from closing, so if we just consider all free fermion Hamiltonians, then that's contractible, right, because the Hamiltonian H equals 0 is in that class. So there's no non-trivial topology there. Okay. Now, on the other hand, if the gap remains open, okay, if the gap is never allowed to close, then the space of free fermion Hamiltonians in general will be topologically non-trivial, of course, depending on dimension and the amount of symmetries you involve and so on. Now, you might say, well, why do I care about free fermion Hamiltonians? Well, the answer is, you know, this includes not just free fermion Hamiltonians with gaps. This includes not just band insulators, but actually, at low temperatures, superconductors can be thought of as a free fermion Hamiltonian, at least as far as their fermionic excitations are concerned. The superconducting order parameter is basically fixed at low temperatures, and really, this is true of any ordered phase in which a low-energy effective field theory has gap fermions. If their interactions, their residual interactions, are irrelevant, we can basically forget about them. And if their interactions with other gap bosons or fluctuates the order parameter are irrelevant, we forget about those too, and we just at low energies treat it as a free fermion problem. So when we in thinking about free fermion problems, we really are also thinking about ordered states of matter in which the parameters in the Hamiltonian may be the expectation values of some bosonic fields. Okay. And then topological defects in such systems are non-trivial homotopy groups of occur when you have a non-trivial higher homotopy group of the space of Hamiltonians. Okay. So I'm very briefly going to review this. There's actually two very different approaches, okay, to this topological classification. One due to Shinseryu and collaborators, which comes about from classifying the possible protected edge states of such systems, and a different one due to Alexei Kataev, which is really kind of more taking the bulk on head-on, which involves classifying vector bundles over the Brillouin zone, also known as K-theory. They both lead to the same classification. Okay, I'm going to follow actually this latter way of thinking because it's a little bit it's sort of more set up for our purposes. Okay, the basic idea is this. Let's consider the simplest example: zero-dimensional system. So you have a bunch of fermionic levels, zero dimensions. In general, the Hamiltonian will just be some free fermion Hamiltonians. It's just something quadratic like this. We're not going to assume any particular symmetries. We're not going to assume charge conservation. We're not going to assume time reversal or spin rotational symmetry or anything like that. So rather than dealing with electron operators, we'll break the electrons into Majorana fermions in this way and just write down the most general Hamiltonian for Majorana fermions. The only condition is that it's A is an antisymmetric matrix. Okay, and there's no conditions. There's no sense in which these are different lattice sites so that A has some locality condition. We're not assuming any of that. So this is really a zero-dimensional system. Every A is coupled to every other A in principle. Okay. So A is just a real antisymmetric matrix, but any real antisymmetric matrix can't be diagonalized, but it can be brought into this form. Well, it can be diagonalized, but of course eigenvalues aren't real. But it can be brought into this form with an orthogonal transformation. Okay. in which you have pairs of eigenvalues, lambda and minus lambda, okay? And, you know, by assumption, these are all greater than zero. So, in fact, if we're just interested in the topology of this space, we might as well continuously deform the A's so that all these lambdas become one, okay? That obviously isn't going to close the gap, and we're only interested in the topology of this space, so the magnitudes of these eigenvalues is unimportant. So, in fact, the most general A is really of this form. It's up to an orthogonal transformation. It's just this matrix, okay, with all lock diagonal 2x2 matrices, which are I sigma y's, okay? Now, how many such matrices, or what is the space of such matrices? Well, the space of such matrices, okay, is, of course, the space of these orthogonal transformations, O, modulo the ones that commute with J, okay? But the orthogonal matrices which commute with J are actually just the unitary matrices. So, in fact, A, the space of these A's is just the coset of the orthogonal group by the unitary group, okay? Another, so that's a fact that you just may know. Another way to think about the same thing is to observe that A is a linear transformation, okay, on R2n, okay, on 2n-dimensional real vector space. It defines a complex structure, okay, because it squares to minus 1. Once we made all the eigenvalues 1 and minus 1, the matrix squares to minus 1. And since it squares to minus 1, it defines a complex structure, by which I mean if you take any vector in this real vector space and I want to define multiplication by a complex scalar, well, I can define it as, you know, A times V plus V times this matrix times V. Okay? So it's a way of defining complex structure. So the set of possible A's is the set of complex structures. Well, the set of complex structures is, of course, take one complex structure and rotate it in all possible ways. That's O2n. Except you should mod out by all those rotations with respect to that complex structure, which are, of course, the unitaries. Okay? So the space of gap-free fermion Hamiltonians in zero dimensions is topologically equivalent to the coset space O2n mod un. And if you want to know how many classes of such transformations there are, you should find out how many disconnected components this space has. And in fact, it has two disconnected components. There are two different classes of such Hamiltonians. Okay. Now, the problem we're really interested in is three dimensions. Now, this kind of classification can be extended to, you know, imposing various types of symmetries and going to various dimensions. I'm just going to go to the case that we're interested in here, which is three-dimensional systems with also with no symmetry. So charge conservation is allowed to be violated, time reversal, any symmetry is allowed to be violated. So it's really, in some sense, the most general symmetry class in three dimensions. Now, in going to a three-dimensional system, we, of course, now have to encode locality, so it's not just an arbitrary matrix. But what we can do is we can take that matrix and, in momentum space, expand it about a minimum of the gap, or if there are multiple minima, about multiple minima of the gap. And in expanding it, it now takes the form of the Dirac equation plus some mass matrix. Okay. Now, this is intuitively kind of appealing in, from a physics point of view. Well, you just take some gap Hamiltonian, you expand around the minimum, and it should look kind of like a massive Dirac equation. That can actually be formalized. There's this theorem due to Kataev that actually proves that you can write it in this form. There are also theorems in K-theory, in particular due to Atiyah, Bhatt, and Shapiro that also essentially prove that you can understand in this way. So we're going to, for the next two slides, I'm just going to work with this Dirac equation. And I'm going to now also assume without loss of generality that all the Majorana fermions here have the same gap, which is equal to 1, okay? Because, again, the gap is something different, we can deform them, and that obviously won't close the gap, and we're only interested in the topology of this space moment. So then, what's satisfied by this matrix M? Well, this matrix M should anti-commute with the gammas and square to minus 1. And as usual, the gammas should all anti-commute and square to 1. Okay. So with that in hand, and following the same kind of logical steps that I did in the last slide, we can understand the topology of this space, okay? So let's first think about the gamma matrices. Well, since gamma squares to 1, it's a linear map, which, and so it's a linear map, and so it decomposes a real two n-dimensional vector space into its positive and plus 1 and minus 1 eigenspaces. So let's go ahead and make that decomposition. Then observe that gamma 2 times gamma 3 squares to minus 1, and commutes with gamma 1. So that tells you that gamma 2 times gamma 3 is actually a complex structure on both x plus and trivially also on x minus. So we can understand that space x plus as n over 2-dimensional complex vector space. And then finally, if we look at the matrix gamma 2n, so the number of ways of choosing this or the different topological classes or the space of choices of gamma of m or the space of choices of gamma 2m, it will be boiled down to the following. So since it squares to 1 and commutes with gamma 1, we can use this to decompose this space x plus, which we understood is n over 2-dimensional complex vector space, into its plus and minus eigenspaces. So in fact, this is now a real eigenspace, a real subspace of this complex vector space. And since it anti-commutes with gamma 2, gamma 3, its complement is sort of I times that real vector space. So it's the number of ways, so it's the different possible choices of a real vector space within a complex n over 2-dimensional vector space. So again, the logic here is I'm assuming that gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3 are fixed, and I want to know how many ways you can choose m. And that's just given by the possible ways of choosing real subspaces of a complex vector space. And that's all possible rotations of a fixed real subspace. So all rotations of this complex vector space are these un rotations, and then mod out by the ones that keep the real space fixed, which is om. Okay. So whereas what I described in the T.O. Cain paper was that we should think about basically some kind of order parameter that's a vector field living on S, you know, it's a unimodular vector field. In fact, the most general thing is actually to think of it as an order parameter that lives in this coset space U mod O. Okay. And you can actually continue in the same way. So I talked about just the zero-dimensional case with no symmetries and the three-dimensional case with no symmetries. But actually, you can, you know, impose some extra symmetries. That puts some extra conditions on the matrices and continue in this way by changing the types of symmetries you have or the spatial dimension and get a classification, which due to Kitaev, which is eightfold periodic in both directions. And then to compute all the homotopy groups of these, you can use Bott periodicity, which basically tells you that you can relate homotopy groups for one of these spaces to different homotopy groups for other ones. And then by inspection, you can also compute the pi zeros of all of these. So kind of all the tools are here to compute the number of classes of Hamiltonians and also the possible topological defects using these relations here. So, you know, we used to think about topological defects in superconductors where we just allow the order parameter to vary. Here we're doing something a little more general. We're allowing this free fermion Hamiltonian to vary and, in principle, explore that entire space of free fermion Hamiltonians in three dimensions, which means that the superconducting order parameter is varying, but potentially there could also be charge density wave orders or spin density wave orders or any kind of order parameters allowed to come in and vary however you like. The Hamiltonian can explore that entire space. And there will be stable topological defects if the second homotopy group is non-trivial. Okay? And actually, from the previous slide, the second homotopy group is Z2. Okay? So in a sense, there are something like these hedgehogs in this system. However, they only carry a Z2 quantum number. They don't have arbitrary winding numbers. Okay? And the T.O. Cain model, which had this order parameter living in S2, is sort of a special case, which is actually the n equals 2 case, in a sense, because in that special case, U2 mod O2 is up to a U1 factor is just S2. And so that's sort of the case they were talking about. But I'm going to focus actually on the large n case, which is kind of more natural in the sense for reasons that I can discuss later. Okay. Okay, so how do I understand, you know, the configuration space of a bunch of defects in this free fermion? Yeah.
If you have S2 factor there, so how do you get a pi 2 that's only a Z2? If you look at this, U2 mod O2 is
in. That's right. So U2 mod O2 is not in the stable limit. So this pi 2, I should say. This is large n, yeah.
But their pi 2 would be the.
Yes, their pi 2 is Z. That's correct. Their pi 2 is Z. I think it's a little unnatural to consider a case where n is small. And for reasons that we can come back and discuss later, actually, the large n is sort of the more natural setting for this. Let me give a heuristic description of the configuration space. I can also give a more precise one, but probably time will not permit that. So let me just, this one is kind of the intuitive way of thinking about it. So let's think actually for a moment just about, well, some of what I say holds just as well if we had an order parameter living on the sphere as one living in U mod O. And where there's some differences, I'll point them out. So consider, you know, some or some texture, some order parameter configuration, and look at the pre-image of the North Pole. So all the places where that vector points to the North Pole. Well, that's going to be a set of loops and arcs, okay? And those arcs are going to connect these hedgehogs. A hedgehog, of course, contains every direction. It's that kind of singularity. And so these things will terminate on hedgehogs. And if you furthermore consider not only the pre-image of the North Pole, but also some tangent vector in the tangent plane to the North Pole, then you're going to get arc framed arcs. So you'll have arcs with tangent vectors associated with them. So these arcs can twist around. Okay? And the configuration of these arcs, so the choice of the North Pole was arbitrary. Had I chosen something else like the South Pole, say, I would have gotten some different set of arcs. However, those arcs, for a given choice, those arcs essentially summarize what the order parameter is doing in between the hedgehogs. And in fact, for the most part, it's really the whole story as far as the topology is concerned. Okay. So the configuration space that we're interested in is all possible configurations of these defects and arcs. And the fundamental group is the equivalence classes of loops in this configuration space, or equivalence classes of defect motions with the same initial and final configurations. So let's take a look at one, you know, some of these motions. And in fact, these are generators of this fundamental group. So here are the points of defects, the locations of defects. These are these arcs that I described that connect them. And you should resist the temptation to think of this direction as time, because it's not. This direction from left to right is time. And what you have here is just the arcs that connect these different defects. So I have four defects over here. And this generator, which I'll call TI, is one in which I took these, let's say, two defects. Well, let me do it this way. Two defects over here, and I've performed a counterclockwise exchange. Now, because the order parameter gets dragged around between these hedgehogs, you can see these arcs get tangled up with each other when you make an exchange. And in order to heal it so that you come back to the same initial state as you start out with, you need to perform some surgery. So you need to then heal up the order parameter around, and that involves bringing these arcs together, cutting them, and then untwisting these arcs. So it's a sequence of operations here in which you first permute to hedgehogs, you then cut and rejoin these arcs between them, and then you untwist one of these arcs is what you need to do, is the analog of a configuration, is the analog of a permutation here. So you can see that because of the order parameter configuration between these hedgehogs, there's more to it than just permutations, okay? And in fact, you can see that this operation is not equal to its own inverse, unlike in the case of permutation group, because its inverse is actually one in which you end up twisting the other hedgehog, in which you do the rejoining in such a way that you end up twisting the other hedgehog. And in fact, it doesn't square to one, unlike in the permutation group. And what it squares to is, in fact, something in which the hedgehogs don't move at all, but you have to perform some twisting of the hedgehog. So you first twist one, you cut and rejoin the loops in a certain way, and then you twist the other. But you only can do this once, because as the usual thing, that a 4-pi twist can be undone. So a 2-pi twist you can't undo, but then a 4-pi twist, you know, kind of the classic demonstration going back to Feynman and so on. So as a result, these things do actually square to 1. Okay. Now, these operations, when they're distant, commute, meaning if they operate on disjoint hedgehogs, that they commute with each other. And furthermore, the X's, in fact, if they operate on neighboring hedgehogs, they actually also, unlike the T's, the X's do commute. And to verify that, what you should do is consider a space, a time history that corresponds to this operation, and a time history that corresponds to the operation on the right-hand side, and then a one-parameter family of histories that interpolates between those two, which is what I've shown for you here. And you can thereby show that, in fact, the left side, hand side is equal to the right-hand side. So that the Xi's, in fact, just form a bunch of copies of Z2. Okay, they don't twist the particles. They only twist the particles and don't permute them. Okay, yes. The TIs, on the other hand, both twist and permute particles. Okay, and they don't necessarily commute with each other. So what you can see basically when you start looking at these kinds of operations, start drawing pictures and permute particles and then cut the arcs and so that you can heal them and untwist, is that basically the elements of the fundamental group either twist an even number of ribbons like this, which involves a twist of one, you kind of do a surgery to transfer the twist over to the other and then untwist it, or they perform an even permutation, okay, which would be something like this, which doesn't involve any twisting at all and involves a cyclic permutation of three hedgehogs, or they twist an odd number of ribbons and perform an odd permutation like one of our generators. And in this way, you can convince yourself that the fundamental group of the configuration space is actually the semi-direct product of a bunch of Z2s times a permutation group, and this E, meaning even part, just means that the total parity of the Z2 part and the permutation part has to be even. Okay. Now, the semi-direct product here is actually extremely natural. It's simply the statement that if you act with one of these Z2s, which transfers twists among hedgehogs, and then you act with the permutation group, you're then twisting the permuted particles, not the original particles. Okay.
A quotient group modding out another Z2.
Yeah, it's not a quotient group, actually. It's not. Yeah, it does. It is a group homomorphism, but it doesn't split, so it's not a quotient group. Yeah. Okay. I'm definitely not going to have time to describe. So there. If you're interested, I can quote chapter and verse of an actual calculation that gives this almost the same answer, which I'm not going to have time to discuss now. And the final answer is almost what I just wrote down. There turns out to be an extra Z2, but that actually doesn't depend on the number of particles. And sorry, this should be a 2n rather than m. And so this is this thing that we call the ribbon permutation group. It's an extension of the permutation group. Okay, so it's a permutation group together with these twists. Okay. And so this is sort of the final answer of a calculation for this model. And what we'd like to know is, you know, okay, so what does this have to do with these Majorana particles in 3D? So let me rewrite this group. It's generated by a bunch of generators, which satisfy some relations. Their fourth powers are equal to one. These gradeless operations, which are the squares of these generators, all commute with each other and give this subgroup of this group, which is a bunch of copies of Z2. Now, we identify these generators with Teo and Kane's unitaries, so the representation of one of these generators is given by these gamma matrices in the way that we discussed. And so this should be, you know, so this should be the question to which Teo and Kane's unitaries are the answer, right, or the representation. Except that if you then look at the representation of one of these gradeless operations, it's a product of Majorana fermion operators, and on neighboring gradeless operations, they actually anti-commute, you can check, whereas in fact those same elements in the group actually commute. So it turns out that this is actually not a linear representation of the fundamental group of the configuration space. It's actually only a projective representation, which is to say the multiplication rule is only reproduced up to a fit. So that's kind of the big surprise from this calculation, that these unitary transformations are not a representation of the fundamental group of multi-defect configuration space. Now, projective statistics were first suggested actually by Wilczek more than 10 years ago, although he suggested that you might have projective representations of the permutation group, and this was criticized on the grounds it would violate locality, although it wasn't really explained why it would violate locality. And since this is a conference on entanglement, I'm now going to explain why the original idea didn't work by mentioning Alice and Bob. So the idea basically is if Alice starts out with some initial state of this form, superposition of spins up and down, and performs a sequence of operations, which are basically permutations. So Alice can permute particles 1 and 2, permute or not permute particles 1 and 2, and Bob can permute or not permute particles 3 and 4. Those are the operations sigma 1 and sigma 3. And let's say those are all very far away. Well, if Alice performs the following operation at just before time t equals 0 and the following operation just after time t equals 0, which is to say permutes the particles if the spin is up just before time t equals 0 and permutes them if the spin is down just after time t equals 0, and then finally at a later time performs a permutation, then that will just lead back to the same original state, okay, at late times, unless Bob, who is far away, performed a permutation, okay, in which case, because of the anti-commutation of sigma 1 and sigma 3, there would be a difference. Okay. Now, this model, on the other hand, in Teo and Kane's construction, this is not a problem. You don't violate causality because you never really have disjoint regions here with these particles because, you know, they are connected by these ribbons. Well, the ribbons are kind of a notional thing that basically is telling us that there's an order parameter configuration between these particles that you can't forget. And so you're never really doing something with disjoint regions because you are moving the particles, but then you also have to heal the entire order parameter between them. Okay. Another manifestation of this is that, you know, even in the best case scenario in which the system is maximally symmetric, there will, as a result of the, you know, this order parameter between them, be a linear confining force between these defects. In fact, it could be much worse, but at best case scenario, it would be a linear confining force between these defects. And in a sense, that may actually explain why a projective representation arises here, which is that because of this force that's not falling off, that's very strong between the particles far away, the overall phase associated with exchanging shouldn't be a topological quantity. Okay. On the other hand, you might think that the overall phase gets messed up, but maybe some non-abelian aspect of this is left over, and that seems to be what's happening here. Okay. So you might think, well, how can I cure this problem that there's this linear confining force? And you say, well, let's just, for instance, the simplest way, let's just gauge this order parameter and get rid of it. And then that hedgehog will become a Tilf-Polyakov monopole. So just take their Hamiltonian like this. You know, what I was referring to, this linear confining force, is coming out of gradients in this order parameter. Well, why not just gauge this whole thing? Unfortunately, what happens if you do that is this resulting gauge theory suffers from Witten's SU2 anomaly. If you then try to cure that anomaly, you also lose the Majorana zero modes. So it looks like both because of the locality, you know, constraint that I told you about here, and because of the failure of a direct fix, that this really isn't something that's going to happen for truly localized point particles, that you can't get rid of this linear confining force between them. Okay. So just to conclude then, you know, defects in three-dimensional systems can have Majorana zero modes, and it actually occurs, you know, for these configurations, okay, in the space of gap-free Fermion Hamiltonians. You know, the defects have non-trivial quote-unquote exchange statistics, okay, which involves not only exchanging the particles but also healing the intervening field between them. The real surprise here, or one of the surprises, is that it realizes a projective rather than a linear representation of the fundamental group of the multi-defect configuration space, which is to say there's an extra purely quantum mechanical minus one. On the other hand, it does not look like it's possible to realize this type of statistics with something like truly weakly coupled quasi-particles. Okay, thank you.
So everything you said here seems like it applies to 2D, but stuff works in 2D. So what doesn't make it linear confined in 2D?
Oh, in 2D?
Yeah.
No. I mean, well, in 2D, first of all, you have a break group, right? So.
Well, but okay, but you change. So if you did the same thing in 2D, it wouldn't.
Yeah. So first of all, in 2D, if you had a two-dimensional system like the one I described over here, I mean, take that same Hamiltonian. Yeah. First of all, it would be a logarithmic rather than a linear confined force.
Okay.
Secondly, you can gauge it in 2D and no problem.
So there's no SU2 anomaly.
That anomaly is special to 3+1 dimensions. Yeah. So
it would work.
It works. In fact, that's how you get Eisenhoweniums in 2D. So 2D is okay.
What if you just gauge the U1?
Yeah, so if you just gauge the U1, you probably weaken the confining force, but I don't think you... And in fact, in real life, the U1 is caged in a sense because that's electromagnetism. But so I think you might weaken the confining force, but I don't think it goes away.
Are there statistics, or are there representations which are universal for quantum computation amongst this subgroups?
Yeah, so I think the answer is no. And the reason is, there's a reason why, which is that even if you allow for projective representations and not just linear representations, the answer is no, because you can see that this is an extension of the permutation group, that it's, you know, a little more complicated than a semi-direct product permutation group with something. And it so happens that Eisenhoweniums, actually, the image of the Bray group can be understood as this kind of extension of the permutation group, but that's not true, for instance, for the Banach anions. It's not in any sense an extension of the permutation group, so.
Right, but this isn't enabling only icing anion type things, right? There are other types of anions presumably that come out of this? Or
well, that hasn't been extensively studied. So, you know, what Tio and Kane did is they just constructed something specifically with ionizing anions, but, you know, until this, we didn't know what it was that they were constructed representations of. And we now see that what they did is a projective representation of this group. You can then ask the question, what other representations can you have? And that hasn't been answered fully, so I don't know the answer, but I highly doubt you'll get anything like Fibonacci anions. Okay? And I mean, the fact is, this is a finite group, right? Yeah. Unlike a Bray group. So I don't think you're getting, I mean, I'm certain you're not going to get something that's computationally universal. And, you know, I also don't think you would even accidentally, for, you know, some small numbers, get anything like Fibonacci anions.
If there are no other questions, let's thank our speaker again.